Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller, this is NPR News. Best-selling romance writer Judith Krantz died last month at 91 in her Bel Air mansion. She lived like a character from her novels, opulence and wealth and designer decadence. But Judith Krantz was the quintessential late bloomer. She didn't publish her first novel until she was in her early 50s, and as the New York Times wrote in her obituary, almost single-handedly turned the sex and shopping genre of fiction into the stuff of high commerce. She was someone who needed time and experience and apparently shopping-fueled wisdom to fulfill her potential. And that's what this show is about today. Forbes magazine publisher and writer Rich Karlgaard argues in his new book that we are, quote, trapped by our cultural worship of the precociously talented and the youthfully ambitious, and that obsession is inhibiting opportunities for people who are on a slow build to success. He adds, a healthy society needs all of its people to realize that they can bloom and rebloom, grow and succeed throughout their lives. So as Rich Karlgaard joins us, I want to know how this fits into your life and your experience. Did it take you some years of wandering, career starts and stops, patience and discovery to figure out how you were meant to contribute to the world? Tell me about the path and where it led. And as a parent, look inside your family, look inside yourself. Are you pushing your kids into a reluctant early blooming? So talk to me a bit about your own path in this world, early success, late blooming success. And then I'd love to hear from some parents this morning about how you think about this and how this works in your own family. Are you pushing your kids, edging your kids into what they might think is a reluctant early blooming? Okay, here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I, M-P-R. Rich Karlgaard is the publisher of Forbes magazine. He's the author of the new book, Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. And he joins us today from Stanford, California. Rich, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me, Carrie.
One of the things that you delve into in this book is something interesting that we have talked about numerous times before on the show. And it is this idea that if you have early success, it's because you're somehow fated to have that success. You know, you were born with more talent and greater intelligence and special luck than the average person. And that's why you're succeeding as an early bloomer. And in some ways, and I think you touch on this, it makes this idea of early blooming more mystical and unattainable and admirable in some ways in the culture. What'd you find out about it?
There are people who are prodigies. They're early bloomers. They tend to reveal their skills very early, whether in history, people like Mozart, or maybe more recently, the early bloomers, some is the child who does exceptionally well in organized classes. They do exceptionally well on standardized tests. You can tell that they're headed for stardom in high school, stardom in college, often at elite universities. And then they go off and get jobs at places like Google or Goldman Sachs, and they shoot out of the gates very rapidly. The big fallacy that we've blundered into in this country, my core belief is that we're putting that model of early success on all kids, and all kids are not nature's early bloomers. Many kids simply do not do well in school. They do well on standardized tests. They might be really good critical thinkers, but they're slow thinkers, whereas standardized tests reward rapid thinkers. Or they may be spatially gifted or artistically gifted or gifted in many other ways. But if we're imprinting on them that if you're not an early bloomer within a very narrow set of criteria, you're somehow a, a second-rate citizen doomed for a mediocre life. That's what,
right.
That's what we've blundered into. And so we've got this epidemic of anxiety, depression, and even suicides among teens and young adults as a result of that.
I think this is so important because you've also hit on this idea of a culture where parenting involves setting up some pretty high bars early on. If you don't get into that, you know, a private kindergarten class, and if you are not succeeding at the age of 7, it's all downhill and you're never going to get into the college that you want to get into. I mean, just these constant hurdles that kids have to hit and you know, bounce over because it's all leading to some exclusive college, and then that's setting you up for great success.
Yeah, there's a in Manhattan. Now, granted, Manhattan is not the United States, but it's an extreme example of this early achievement mania. In Manhattan, there are preschools that charge $45,000 to $50,000 a year. And when you go to their websites, you see that your kids at age 3 will be exposed to multiple languages in a multi-building campus. And what the not-so-subtle message is if you don't do this now, parents, for your 3-year-olds, then 15 years later, when they don't get into Princeton or Harvard, you will be to blame. And that's kind of extreme. And if you want to go even more extreme and even perverted and criminal, look at the recent college bribery scandal, where it's simply the logical extension of if you don't give your kids this push, that they're going to somehow fail on their own. And that's just grossly underestimating their kids and human resilience.
From Twitter, I'm going to come back to resilience because I thought what you wrote about that was interesting. On Twitter, a listener says, I'm turning 40 this year and I'm at my peak right now. My 20s were riddled with multiple failures and self-doubt coupled with drug and alcohol abuse. But at this point in my life, I'm tying up the loose ends one by one and living my best life. If I only knew then what I know now. Let me grab a call here from Tina in Eagan. Hi, Tina. How does this work in your own experience?
Hi. Yeah, I spent 20 years in corporate right out of school, you know, because I did what my parents told me to do, go get an education, get a job. And in my mid-40s, I decided to quit and kind of showed my kids, you know, you don't have to go into what you think is your lifelong career. And in my mid-40s, I started a business and took everything I learned from my 20 years of corporate and put it into my business. And now I have my teenager working for me, and he can kind of see where my past corporate life actually adds to what I'm doing now.
You know, in some ways, Tina, I hear you saying, I was on the corporate ladder, and from the outside looking in, hey, that looks really successful. But you weren't afraid to kind of buck this conventional wisdom that says, boy, you get on that ladder and you keep climbing till you can't climb any further. Is that fair to say?
Totally fair to say, because that's like what's expected. And now with like working moms, they have that sort of guilt about them that I'm going to go to work and show my kids that I can work.
Yeah.
But if you're going home every day not liking what you've done, your kids see that, and then they can kind of see that that's what I'm doomed for, is to work for the man. And I'm kind of showing my kids, you don't have to have that life and you have to like what you do.
Yeah. Rich, what do you hear in that?
Well, I hear a very inspirational story. In fact, in my book, I have a whole chapter on the virtues of quitting. Popular culture makes us all feel guilty if we quit. And I will grant you that quitting is the first response to any adversity in our lives, is a very bad habit to pick up. But this idea that we should be able to strategically quit every once in a while when our time, our talent, our treasure, our purpose are not being used optimally or used in a way that really deeply motivates us is something that we all need to embrace. I look at so many great entrepreneurs. Richard Branson is in the news today because he's going to take his space company public. Richard Branson, a great serial entrepreneur, has quit as many businesses as he's persisted in. He quit Virgin Brides. He quit Virgin Cola. You know, there comes a point, as the case of Tina, when you've gotten all that you can get from your, you know, in Tina's case, picking up a lot of knowledge about how businesses really work, but then once she felt that she'd plateaued, going out on her own. And it's a spectacular story of success.
I don't want to miss the resilience piece of this. I thought this was really interesting in your book. You pondered whether early blooming impairs the development of resilience. And you sent me down a little rabbit hole here, and I was reading some of the research of Ann Hulbert, who wrote this book about the mythology that we have about prodigies and early talent and resilience. And she said, what prodigies want and need is the chance to obsess on their own idiosyncratic terms, to sweat and swerve, lose their balance, get their bearings, battle loneliness, discover resilience. So we think that if you're born with a special gift or you look like an early bloomer, it's all just a smooth path from there on in. But what you might be missing is this very important piece of resilience. What did you learn about that as you were researching the book?
Well, I'll cite a conversation I had with an amazing woman, Carol Dweck, who teaches psychology at Stanford. And she wrote a best-selling book a dozen years ago called Mindset. And perhaps many listeners have read it.
I'm familiar with it, yeah.
And so I interviewed Carol Dweck, and I said, congratulated her on Mindset, and you must be really proud. And she said, well, it got traction where I didn't think it would get traction in the business world, but it's made no dent at all in the academic world where I wanted it to make a dent. And I said, do tell. And then she leaned forward, and she said, the kids I see at Stanford today, and she teaches a freshman class at Stanford, the kids I see today coming in at age 18 are exhausted, they're brittle, and they don't want to mar their perfect records. They should be jumping for joy, Carrie. They just got into, you know, an Ivy League equivalent school that looks like a Club Med. And who wouldn't want to go to Stanford? But she said these kids are brittle and exhausted. And so I think that we're actually leeching out their resistance rather than letting them exercise their own curiosity and muscles, and is that very poetic passage that you cited.
Jonathan says on Twitter, what's interesting to me is in schools we see the research which looks at the importance of resilience over and over again, but the rest of society seems to deem early blooming more important, as you noted, Rich, hence the reliance on standardized tests. To the phones here to Laura in Eagan. How does this fit with your own life and experience, Laura?
When I was younger, I was in Mensa. I was seen as a gifted child. However, through that, it also held me back in multiple ways.
Mm.
I got 4 years ahead in math, so I didn't have math for 4 years because it was fine. I was at that level. I feel like I've been both an early bloomer and a late bloomer because it's taken me years to to process failure and trying again and the fact that that doesn't mean that everything is a failure. And I think it's really important that even with gifted children, that they're, as was mentioned, they're allowed to grow at their pace and they're allowed to explore their world, because otherwise kids do end up brittle.
It really sounds, Laura, like you gained a lot of wisdom on your own, you know, experience with this. Being, did you say you were in Mensa as a real young girl?
Yes, I was.
Huh. But now you look back and say upside, downside, and I missed a lot because I was being propelled so quickly through the education system. Yeah.
I was being homeschooled as well.
Ah.
So that also did not help.
Right.
And even now it's made, once you hit a part that you don't intuitively understand in school, it makes everything so, so much harder. And I really don't think that's fair to future generations.
Yeah, really good to have your call, Laura. Thanks. Rich, I think this is a good moment for us to note that you yourself were a pretty late bloomer. You write that high mediocrity and alienation seemed my fate, Were you aware in the moment that you were underachieving, or did this just feel like, well, this is my life?
I had a sense of that I hadn't put things together in high school. I barely made the top 20% of my graduating class, which was the cutoff for the honor roll. I think I might have been in the hanging on by my fingernails. I went to my local junior college. By a series of flukes, which I recount in the book, I got into Stanford. But Stanford in the 70s was a place where they admitted 25% of applicants and 40% of JC transfers. So it was nothing like the Stanford of today. I was a poor student. I hung out in the library and read back issues of Sports Illustrated instead of studying. I couldn't study for more than 15 or 20 minutes. And so at age 25, when my roommates were off doing spectacular things like finishing up law school and beginning fantastic legal careers or working on the space shuttle program, things like that, at age 25, I was a temporary typist, I was a dishwasher, and I was a security guard. And to recount the low moment at 25 when I'm a graveyard security guard at a trucking firm and I'm making my rounds and I hear a dog barking and I swing my flashlight around and there's a Rottweiler glaring at me through the chain-linked fence. And it occurred to me with a sense of great shame that at age 25, my professional colleague was a dog.
Rich Karlgaard is with us this morning. We're talking about the book. The story goes on from there, by the way. We're talking about the book Late Bloomers, The Power of Patience in a World Obsessed with Early Achievement. And you can hear that Rich is blending in a lot of his own experience here, but also taking an interesting look at the culture that rewards early blooming, high achievement, youthful ambition at such a young age, and what that means for the need for late bloomers, what this, the kind of pressure that it's putting on kids. And I wonder how this fits with your own experience, whether you are someone who it took some years of wandering and career starts and stops and patience and discovery to figure out how you were meant to contribute to your community and to the world. Tell me a bit about that path. And as a parent, is this something that you're tempted to do? Because, again, culture really rewards high achievement at the earliest ages. How do you resist that for your kids? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter, at CarrieMPR, to Diana in San, or Dana, I'm sorry. Hey, Dana, hi, in St. Paul.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for waiting.
Good morning. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a couple of comments. First of all, I think you could do a week on this and have plenty of material.
Agreed.
But your comments about how we coach our kids. I have two sons, one in junior high and one in high school, and I try to coach them for the long haul, the long path, because you know we're living longer, we're working longer, and so they have an amount of runway, if you will, that is unlike even what we have at middle age, right? And it seems to me that we should coach our kids that you've got lots of options, you've got lots of runway. So, you know, if something doesn't work, try something else and don't be scattershot about it. But on the other hand, you've got that runway. And the other thing, just to tie it back to the comments of your guest a little bit earlier, colleges particularly seem to be so focused on getting kids to choose something to get them in and out of in 4 years or a reasonable amount of time that seems particularly unreasonable in this day and age, or maybe ever, because you know kids, 20-year-olds don't really know what they're going to do or want to do, and so it seems to me it's a little bit opposite of how things really work.
No, that's a really good insight. Although I think, Rich, some of that has happened because tuition is expensive, and students and their parents make sacrifices in many cases to get to college, and it increases the pressure on figure it out early, don't waste that time and study time. And this is, as Dana says, this is a runway to a really good job. You have to maximize the experience, which is really not what college ought to totally be about.
Yes, it doesn't recognize a neurological truth about human beings that from age 18 onward, we're considered legally adults, but most of us don't neurologically arrive at our full adulthood until our middle or late 20s. And there's a neuroscientist at New York University named L. Conan Goldberg, who pegs it even later, in fact, has this intriguing theory that full onset of adult function occurs about one-third of the way through our projected lives. So if kids are going to live longer, it may arrive a little later. And the prefrontal cortex and the final maturity of that gives us that function to be able to tamp down our impulsivity. It allows us to think about consequences more. So when you think about that, when you think about forcing decisions, career decisions, on people who, though they may be adults at age 18, aren't really fully functioning adults until much later, a decade later or so, it makes no sense whatsoever.
You know what occurred to me about this, Rich, is this is in this part of what we're talking about right now with kids and parenting and educating is kind of the antithesis to that whole tiger mom movement thing that happened, I don't know, was it 8 or 9 years ago, where you force your kids into high achievement at an early age and, you know, and the success pays off. I mean, you know who I'm talking about, right? And that whole kind of movement about my kids practice 5 hours a day and they don't like it, but look at them. They're concert pianists. And that kind of proves it out. Do you see this as kind of oppositional to that whole movement?
I wouldn't say. Well, thank you for pointing that out. I think that Amy Chua did a great job in articulating her tiger mom theory and the benefits of applying that kind of discipline to your kids. I would say I'm not oppositional. I would say that I'm complementary in the sense that if the tiger mom approach works, then blessings to you. You know, then keep experimenting with that and keep going. But if the tiger mom approach produces children who are racked with chronic anxiety and fear and depression and are posting dangerous things on social media, that's when you need to step back and say, maybe this approach doesn't work. You know, I come from the world of athletics, particularly my love was running in track and field. And you can take two athletes who both want to run the marathon, and one will thrive running 100 miles a week, and one will break down running 100 miles a week. And so we have to look at kids as individuals. Some, I think a minority of kids will thrive under a tiger mom regime. Many won't.
Call here from Sarah in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hey, Sarah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. How is this, how's this fitting with your own life and your own experience?
Well, so, you know, I was the typical kind of overachieving high school student, and I jumped right into college afterwards. And college was a really difficult experience for me, and I decided to go on to grad school anyway, thinking that it was the right path for me. And so, you know, I spent a lot of time and money and effort doing all of these things, and it didn't really align with what I truly valued and wanted. And so a couple of years ago, I quit my, you know, master's degree job, basically, and decided to open up a bakery instead. And for me, you know, as someone who's nearing 30, to hear this conversation and to hear, you know, someone saying out loud, it's okay to change your mind, it's okay to do something different, it's okay to experiment and find things that align with your values, it's so refreshing. And I really wish that more people would say that to, you know, high schoolers and incoming college students, that it's okay to change your mind. It's going to be all right as long as you can commit to it, you know?
Is your bakery in Sioux Falls? What's the name of it?
It is. So it's called Florette Cakery, and it's a bakery that I actually own and operate out of my home.
That's great.
And I've been doing it for about a year now, and it's, you know, it's hard, it's difficult, it's a learning curve, but I have gained so much from it that I could have never gained the kind of experience that I have now from going to school.
Running a small business. I mean, come on, Sarah. You are, I'm sure you're using your education and the skills that you got from that master's.
Yeah, a lot of transferable skills.
transferable skills for sure.
Right. Hey, thank you very much for the call. Rich, I think this is a good moment to talk about self-doubt. I love the insight that you brought to that. You say the ability to turn self-doubt into information and motivation is key. Such alchemy doesn't happen by chance. I know that there are listeners like Sarah saying, this felt like the right choice. Did I do the right thing? So how do we turn those questions into motivation?
I wrote this chapter on self-doubt because I think popular culture does a disservice to people when it asks us to throw our shoulders back, stand up straight, puff up our confidence, look in the mirror, say inspirational things. I don't think that's a sustainable strategy. It's a tactic that can be useful. It can get you through a pinch or a bad day, or maybe get you up for a sales meeting. But self-doubt is like Minnesota weather, right? The weather is going to change. It's going to show up. Self-doubt is going to show up. If we don't have a long-term strategy to deal with self-doubt, then we're always going to have to resort to these tactics until one day those tactics stop working. Now, what we need to do with self-doubt is to step back and clinically look at, well, what information is this self-doubt delivering? Mm. Because if I'm suddenly feeling ill at ease and racked with doubt, there is information in that. Yeah. It might not be information you want to hear. I again go back to Carol Dweck, who said, you know, consider it as the annoying friend who shows up when you least want it, but they always have valuable information. You know, in terms of starting a business, and you have self-doubts about it, maybe it's telling you that you need somebody who can complement your skills. You know, if you're not good at bookkeeping and numbers, maybe you need somebody like that. Maybe you need more preparation. Maybe you need to simply take a break, that you're working a problem too hard to the point of exhaustion and your mind is incapable of fresh insight. So we need to learn the trick of stepping back and looking at our self-doubt and seeing ourselves as we would our best friend. If our best friend was racked with self-doubt, we wouldn't pile on the coals, we would counsel them.
You know, Rich, I interview a lot of fiction writers, and almost every fiction writer, no matter how long they've been doing this, no matter how accomplished they are, suffers from some pretty serious self-doubt. And just as you said, in those moments is the information to say, I worked this through before. Here's what came out of this. Here's what I learned from that. And this is, in the way I work, you know, as a writer, this is truly a valuable part of the creative process. So not to be afraid of it. I've heard a lot of kind of intuitive, insightful things from writers on this. There's rarely a writer who says they have vanquished it for good and moved on with full confidence. It's a valuable, I think, part of the creative process. And from what you're saying in the book, for building resilience too, for building confidence, which seems a little counterintuitive, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there have been numerous tests that show whether you're a golfer trying to make a putt, or you're shooting an arrow from a bow at a target, that confidence is overrated. Confidence can lead you astray. So having self-doubt, welcoming self-doubt, learning how to deal with self-doubt. And I would say the thing that I didn't include in the book, now I wish I would have included, the one paragraph I wish I would have included in the whole book, mm-hmm. is learn to wall off your self-doubt from your self-worth. Ever let your self-doubt infect your self-worth. You have inherent self-worth. You're a human being. You have inherent self-worth. So your self-doubt is just information.
Angela says on Twitter, as the parent of a four-year-old, I already think about this. I knew I was going to be an accountant and I got my master's, but my husband is a high school grad and self-taught web developer. I was taught that college was the only ticket out of working class, but I know that's not true. But to be successful, my husband had to be curious and self-motivated in a way that I wasn't, and needed school to help me along. Not sure yet how we'll teach those lessons to our son if he ends up struggling to find a career path that he likes. To Janie in Minneapolis. Hi, Janie. Thanks for holding.
Thanks.
Through the news. Appreciate it. Yeah, go ahead.
So I am 30 years old, and similar to your previous caller, Sarah, you know, I went to high school. I played three sports. I was in every other club you could imagine.
went to college, had internships, got a really successful job in BC, moved back to Minnesota, mm-hmm. and suddenly I am just burnt out to the point where I actually just left my job. I'm going to take a couple months off,
mm-hmm.
and I can't help but wonder if it's because, you know, just our generation has been pushed to go, go, go so hard. You know, I'm not like a super, super smart person. I'm probably like of average intelligence, so I had to work hard. Mm-hmm. And I want to know if other generations, older generations experience when they turn 30, this when they turn 30, or if it's, you know, or if it's kind of a newer thing because we're feeling more pressure.
I think Rich is a great person to ask that of. What do you think, Rich?
I consider myself very lucky, being a middle-aged baby boomer, that experimentation, remember I told you the story about being a security guard at age 25 when my professional colleague was a dog. I think, as shameful as I felt about that, I had more paths to recover and to come into my own, because there wasn't social media, there wasn't this public shaming of people who were slower to develop. I grew up in a culture where let's say the screw up in high school then went off into the military, and then the next thing you heard, they were successfully raising a family and holding down a job. So I think the caller is speaking to something that is a little newer. In the book, I talk about this woman who did all the right things. She went to got great grades in high school, went to an elite university, went to law school, worked like crazy, you know, 80-hour weeks to make partner at a law firm. And after she made partner of a law firm and she was now in the world of seven-figure salaries, she cried herself to sleep every night. And she was burning out because she was fulfilling other people's expectations. And I think that's the point. And I think the symptoms you should read within yourself, are you feeling pushed or pulled? When you're blooming, really, which means that you're putting together your God-given talents, your passions, your purpose, when all of those are in alignment, you feel like you're being pulled towards something. Oprah Winfrey, I'm getting a little metaphysical here, but Oprah Winfrey called it that moment of supreme destiny, that we're being pulled towards something that has our name on it. And when we're succeeding under somebody else's definition, then we feel pushed. Eventually, we will burn out.
You know, Janie, the other thing is, I think you're going to find this time that you're giving yourself, and maybe you're going to end up needing more than 2 months to be really clarifying. Rich, I mean, you know, we also have this culture where you go right, you end one job and maybe you take a week off and you go right to another job. It's a wonderful moment of opportunity to be able to take some weeks and clarify things and do some physical activity maybe. And so I hope you're not too hard on yourself for doing that. It's a good thing to invest. You're investing in yourself. Yeah,
I actually feel really good about it. I'm training for a marathon. I'm, you know, got projects around the house that I'm finally getting to.
Good.
Spending more time with my family, and I think so far at least it's been one of the best choices I've ever made, and I'm excited to see, you know, what the next couple of months hold out.
I know. Will you tweet at me and let me know, or shoot me an email on where you end up months from now? I hope after you've hit some clarity there. Rich, any more advice for Janie?
I wouldn't worry about Janie at all. Janie is not someone devoid of motivation. She was an achiever, and now she's running a marathon, taking care of projects. You know, that thing that you were meant to do, trust in the process and trust that you will be led to that moment.
Rich, I want to talk to you about an essay that I was reading by Arthur Brooks at the same time that I was reading your book. He's the former president of the American Enterprise Institute, and he's been writing a piece about how our professional life declines, our professional acumen, our intellectual acumen starts to decline at about 50, and that it comes on more quickly than we would like to think. So I want to read you just a couple sentences from the piece. The data are shockingly clear that for most people in most fields, decline starts earlier than almost anyone thinks. And then he cites this research from UC Davis Professor Emeritus Keith Simonton, and he adds, success and productivity increase for the first 20 years after the inception of a career on average. So if you start a career in earnest at 30, expect to do your best work around 50 and go into decline soon after that. So I have to say, if you're a late bloomer and this research is right, you don't really have that much time to, you know, enjoy the fruits of your late blooming, do you?
Yeah, I know Arthur Brooks's piece got a lot of traction on Atlantic.
Yeah, right.
And I beg to differ.
Good. Why?
There was a huge piece of research that came out in 2015 led by a woman named Laura Germine at Harvard and her colleague Josh Hartshorn at MIT. They were both postdoc students at Massachusetts General Hospital. And they asked the question, at what age do we cognitively peak? And the answer is very complex and intriguing and hopeful. And the answer is, what cognitive abilities are you talking about? So if you're talking about rapid algorithmic processing speed, sure enough, you know, we peak in our 20s for that. So if you're going to be a software programmer working under a time crunch in a software factory, you're probably going to peak in your 20s, you know, and not too long after that. In our 30s, 40s, and 50s, we get this whole range of neurological attributes that support wisdom, communication skills, executive leadership, all of those. In our 60s and 70s, we get yet more. Mm-hmm. And I cited this example in my book of a liver transplant surgeon at Mayo. And he said, yeah, you know, at age, he's in his late 60s now. He said, at age, in my early 50s, middle 50s, I began to notice that I wasn't going to get any better in terms of my hand-eye coordination and all of that. And yet my diagnostic abilities kept getting better and better and better. And so how they solve that problem is that he now is paired with a younger liver transplant surgeon who is coming up in the ranks, but doesn't have all that accumulated wisdom and knowledge and is a little bit prone to panic, you know, under a high pressure situation, and they complement each other's skills. So, yeah, I suppose Arthur Brooks is right if you sit still. But if you realize that you're an evolving human being, and that your cognitive abilities will change and you keep moving with that, then there's no reason not to thrive in your career for a long time.
By the way, we tried to reach out to Michael Mattis. I think he's the thoracic surgeon that you mentioned in the book.
Yes.
Who is a late bloomer, went from what, some juvenile delinquency, finally kind of, yeah, you tell the story about him.
Well, it was actually a story I got out of Minnesota Public Television.
Ah.
So I never interviewed Mark, but he was a juvenile delinquent. His mom was an alcoholic. He remembers how dismal it was to be able to have to serve her drinks. And so he just checked out, hung out with the wrong people, eventually, you know, found a mentor who really believed in him. And now he's now he's at the University of Minnesota Med Center doing great work. So a lot, he had a resilience that he picked up in the streets, but it also shows you the value of having a mentor.
I'm getting some tweets this morning from people who are, if you're on the stream hearing the current, I think, overlay on top of our signal, our engineers are aware of it and they're trying to fix it. So, no, you are not supposed to be hearing music over our side of the stream here, but they're working on it. And Rich, I don't know, you're getting emails or something? I'm hearing a lot of dinging on your end of the line here.
Apologies, just shut off my phone.
Thank you. To the phone's Devon.
I wasn't expecting it. You know, I'm on the Pacific Coast here.
It's early.
I'm up with the chickens.
I know. To Vaughn in Eden Prairie. Hi, Vaughn. I really appreciate you waiting. Wanted to get to what you had to say.
Yeah. No, oh, thank you. Thank you for having this conversation. I think it's so essential.
Good.
And I actually wish that more younger people are hearing this as well.
Yeah.
You know, right now I'm in my early 30s, and it took me 7 years to complete my undergrad. And actually, when you're talking about being 25 and a security guard, I was that. I was a student security guard at the U. And I think that, you know,
did
having...
Did you have a badge? Did you have a badge?
I did. I had a badge. yeah. But, you know, I think it's in failing, you know, one major after another and one course after another and sitting in that failure, I now believe was really critical. You know, at the time it was really difficult for me because I had to learn, like you were saying, how to differentiate between my failures and my self-worth. Mm. And while it's not perfect, and I'm still susceptible to that, I think working through some of that has really helped me build resilience and work toward figuring out what am I pulled towards, and sort of tuning out, you know, what family expectations are, what society expectations are, and what how they are defining success.
That's a tall order, though, isn't it, Vaughn? I mean, as you say, tuning it right, because you have to have answers for people who are saying you're 26, you still haven't figured out what you want to do.
Right, absolutely. And, you know, I have a career now, and I've taught adjunct at the university, and, you know, my family will come to me now and say, wow, we never would have expected this from you.
They just didn't know about late blooming, did they?
Right.
Thanks so much for the call. Some good points there. You know, I guess, Rich, I also want to make sure that we put a little bit of pressure on not just the education community, but the corporate community to recognize this and reap the rewards from this, right? There's still plenty of companies that start to say employees are getting into their early 60s and they're cheaper to replace. And what do we really have to get from those employees? What should corporate America understand about this? And I know some do, but overall.
Yeah, I think we're at the beginning of a movement here where companies are beginning to discover the virtues of having age diversity on a team. You know, there's so many kinds of diversity in the diversities that are available that can really move the needle in terms of productivity. There's obviously gender diversity, racial diversity, which get concentrated on for historical reasons, and that's all proper. But thinking style diversity, having introverts and extroverts on a team can be very useful. And age diversity. Now, the trick with age diversity is how do you take senior employees and begin to move them on the downside of their career arc, let's call it, because so many companies have what you might call an up-and-out career track,
right?
That employees get promoted, they get raises, and then suddenly one day somebody reporting to the chief financial officer says, boy, these older people are expensive and they've got healthcare issues and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And yet many of them remain tremendously productive and want to work. I think what we need to do is acknowledge that there might be, and here I will tip my hat to Arthur Brooks, there might be a point when we do peak. And a lot of it has to do with our motivation. Simply after, you know, we get into our 60s and maybe we don't want to work 60 hours a week or 70 hours a week or whatever it takes to maintain momentum on the executive track. We want to be able to begin to downsize. And so why can't we have a negotiation where these kinds of employees can take on the role of mentors and teachers and counselors? Because every employer out there right now is complaining about millennials and Gen Xers. You know, they need coaching. They're technically brilliant, but they don't know how to communicate. They wander, you know, they make mistakes with clients and customers, et cetera. And so there's this huge gap that can be fulfilled, filled by having a more creative way of looking at age diversity within organizations.
A call here from Chris in Stillwater. Chris, I really wanted to get you in. I don't have too much time, so thank you for waiting.
I'll go fast.
All right.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I discerned at age 37 a surprising and unexpected call to ministry, and I ended up going to seminary and graduating at 43.
Well
being
done.
Ordained in the,
well
thank
done.
You.
Yeah.
Being ordained in the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, and our kids were adolescent at the time. And my husband shortly thereafter made a switch from the software industry to work for a conservation NGO and took a huge pay cut. And we both feel like we're finally following our hearts, and the timing in the lives of our children was such that we were able to tell them, don't feel like you have to achieve it all now or make the decision at 17 what your life is going to be. You know, go study what sounds interesting, something you think you can stick with for 4 or 5 years, get your degree and get out there and learn who you are.
Oh, man.
And they're doing that. One of them seems to have hit the ground running. Two of them are going to be late bloomers, but they're all figuring it out.
You know, what you've described there, Chris, is, I think, as valuable as saying you can be anything you want to be, which, you know, my parents and a lot of parents tell kids. But you also don't have to be headlong on the track knowing exactly what that's going to be from the minute you hit high school. Rich, some advice for parents on this, too, if you would.
Well, I'm inspired by that story, and it reinforces my belief that when we tell kids to follow their passions, we're missing something key there, and that is passion married to purpose, because that creates a sense of mission. That's a passion that you're going to be willing to work hard for, sacrifice for. And what I heard in the previous caller was all about this sense of not only mystery, but mission. And I think it's a wonderful story.
We're going to close with Lucinda Williams, who is also a late bloomer. Rich, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for getting up early on the West Coast for us.
Thank you, Carrie, for having me.
Book is called Late Bloomers.
I'm like a fish out of water, a cat in a tree. You don't even want to talk to me. Well, it's old. I know it, but I can't let go. He won't take me back when I come around. A train wreck, well, it's old. I know it, but I can't let go. See, I got a candle that burns so bright in my window every night. Well, it's old. I know it, but I can't let go. You don't like to see me standing around, feel like I've been shot and fall down. Well, it's old.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to the discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet us at @CarrieNPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all our shows by subscribing to this podcast. You can send us your questions or comments by emailing talk@npr.org.